My maiden interviewee for this first episode is none other than the HMC Chair, Sue Woodruff, Principal of the Grammar School at Leeds.
Welcome to the HMC Podcast. Through this, HMC hopes to bring you inspiration during these particularly turbulent times in education and raise awareness of HMC, providing a service for members and raising the profile with a wider audience. Tom Lawson is in the driving seat, and every episode, he'll interview members and others, exploring themes such as testing as exams, partnerships, pastoral care, AI, and the future of education, as well as giving you a two-minute introduction to new members. Each episode will be relaxed, conversational, occasionally controversial, and perhaps even mildly humorous to provide something easy to digest as you drive or as you try to get to sleep, but not at the same time. All views expressed by Tom and the guests are their own. Do please get in touch with ideas, questions or comments by email to pod@hmc.org.uk. Now, let's get into this episode.
Sue, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
I think I'll start by asking you if you listen to any podcasts.
Oh, do you know, I'm hopeless, but I do have a fantastic colleague here at school who listens to a lot. And every time she hears a great one or of a new great series, she does let me know. And then she nags me to try and make sure I've heard one or two from that series. The latest one she's particularly enjoyed is When It Hits the Fan, which is really helpful, I think, for head teachers because it tells you how to cope with all sorts of crisis situations. So I've enjoyed that of late. But on the whole, I need to get better.
Oh, well, I'm not sure it's duty. Car, bath or bedtime for podcasts for you?
Oh, definitely would be car. Absolutely. Great way to spend the time.
Fantastic. So it's going to be a general introductory theme for this first episode. The challenges and priorities for heads and the education sector at the moment. I'm calling it the How Long Can We Last Without Mentioning VAT episode.
Sounds like a great challenge.
Sue, what's your view of the education sector and current challenges?
Well, it's funny, you know, it's sort of the end of my career, you know, in that I've done this for a long time. I think I've seen an awful lot of change. But I think the biggest change that worries me the most is probably the challenge I would put out there at the moment, which is I fear that education's becoming more polarised than it ever has been. I've had a sense, both working in the state sector and the independent sector for over 30 years, that there's always been this real sense of the common purpose, the public good, a real sense of public service that came out of wanting to work in education. And I worry now that we're all becoming very politicised or polarised, which is not actually what drove any of us to want to get involved in this amazing part of a career when we first started. So I think the polarisation issue, the politicisation is a hard thing at the moment. But of course, there are all sorts of areas that we could explore in this podcast as well.
Can I pick up on the polarisation thing? I wonder, do you think it's a species of just a general polarisation in Western politics? We see that in the United States, perhaps in Britain.
Across Europe. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, I think it's just one of those periods of time, isn't it, when everything's become binary. And that's probably exacerbated by the fact that with the, you know, increase in social media, everything has to be reduced to a soundbite or has to be reduced to so many characters. And actually, when do you ever get the nuanced debate that we were used to, certainly when I was growing up? When do you ever get that detailed analysis? And actually encouraging our children to be part of exploring that and not accepting a soundbite or a 30-character expression is really important.
I mean, perhaps you're right, it's a media thing, Sue, because I think when I talk to colleagues in the maintained sector, or indeed when I talk sort of offline to people involved in Labour or Liberal politics, they do have a nuanced view. It's just that's not coming through and it's not their public persona.
Yeah, absolutely. And I worry that more and more the, you know, new breed of politician coming through will be so keen to play to that soundbite world that actually that deeper sense of understanding that we all believe is there actually doesn't get a chance to have its say. And for me, that's quite dangerous in terms of then, you know, just making sure people have got the right level of information to make informed decisions and not to make them based on anything that's too trite.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And before we go down the path of saying everything's getting worse all the time, which I'm certainly we have a tendency to do, I think you wanted to speak a little bit about the focus on the children.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Because I think, again, you know, we would always say, wouldn't we, and the governments of different colours over many years of my career will have said every child child matters, but have said it in different ways. And I just fear that sometimes it's too easy to go off the focus on actually what do our children need and what will put them at the centre and enable them to get the very best for their future that we would all want, and a future that will indeed have a positive impact on the other people around them and the wider world.
Is it easier or is it harder for children now with their issues about relationships and identity?
I think it's so much harder, you know, and I think it goes back to the whole social media piece as well, but it's not just that. You know, I think that there's a greater awareness of one's identity. There's greater role modelling and stereotyping around. I think that, you know, if you think about when children were trying to work out whether they'd done something wrong, whether to, you know, fess up, I think might be in their language, whether to talk openly about something, they could go away and reflect on that overnight after school and decide what they wanted to do or talk to mum and dad, talk to whoever's at home with them. Now, I'm not sure actually parents and carers feature at the front. I think it's their, you know, equally perhaps their friendship groups, the people that they're dealing with on a social media platform. And actually, they don't always have all of the information to give the wisest advice as well. I think if children are having a tough time at school, you could escape that overnight. You can't escape it anymore because it follows you on your phone. It follows you on all of those platforms. So actually, I think it's tougher for children today. And I think we need to make sure that we recognise that in the way we handle situations in our schools.
Now, I think you're absolutely right. We have to really acknowledge it and understand it. But is it a question, you know, that we meant to be up with the times? I recall my mother's father, you know, breaking her Beatles records because that media was a bad influence on them. And, perhaps it was always thus.
Perhaps it was always thus, you know. And maybe the key thing is to make sure that we can help our children and students to be as discerning as possible. How do they do their own due diligence in the middle of the maelstrom that might be that issue that's really important for their friendship group at that moment in time? How do we teach them and encourage them to take the step back, to do the evaluation, to reflect for a moment and not just pounce into a thought or an action or a WhatsApp message or something that could actually cause the situation to become even more inflamed?
Well, they probably don't have to do any thinking in the future because of AI. What are your thoughts on harnessing that for the education sector?
Well, I think harnessing is absolutely the correct verb, Tom, because I think this is something that's going to be so exciting. And I worry that, you know, sometimes our children and students might think, oh, you know, they just don't want us to do that at school because they think we're just going to copy everything and plagiarise everything. Actually, you know, the fact that they're already using AI in so much of their work, just on Microsoft Office functions, for example, in their own world, on their phones and on their laptops, they're already using it very often when they don't even realise it. And for me, it is about harnessing it. How do we say there will be some amazing advantages for learning that will come out of this, that will benefit teachers, that will benefit students? And how do we manage that in such a way as to make sure it's done responsibly? I think that's the real challenge of the future. But gosh, what an exciting challenge. And I think for our wider school staff as well, there'll be huge efficiencies and economies that we'll be able to realise just by being able to use AI in a clever way. So I really feel I'm absolutely at the foothills of this, and I know several people are already climbing the mountain, and I am fascinated by the learning that they're sharing so far, and it's only going to grow and grow, and I think that's a really exciting challenge.
Yeah, well, perhaps we can do an episode on that and get those folk in, because I'm similarly incompetent. I got a cold call from an AI this morning asking if I had damp, which I thought was a little personal.
I was going to say, did they say where?
Yeah, well, I think they meant the house, and so, well, at least I hope so. And, you know, I don't get very many calls on my mobile, so I tried to make friends, but eventually she hung up on me. There you go. What do you see as the sector's priorities for 2024 and beyond, Sue?
Sure. And, you know, I think for a start, you know, just looking after these young people, having them at the centre means that, you know, the post-COVID impact is going to go on for many, many years to come, isn't it? We're going to see it come through academically. We're seeing it come through all the time in terms of behaviour. And absolutely, we're seeing it in terms of the mental health crisis that's out there. So the reality is that is something we are going to have to grapple with. And we're going to have to be as creative as possible in the ways that we try to support and help not just our young people but actually also their families and their carers.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know how long we can use the post-COVID excuse. I mean, it was such a enormous sort of caesura in the life of the nation. Even in the war, we didn't stop schools, did we? So I suppose it's going to have a lasting effect.
It's funny, you know, I mean, one of the great blessings in my job is it's a through school from 3 to 18. So, you know, it's a big school. So I get to do 4 nativity plays every December. But it's interesting when you're listening, just even to the quality of speech, you're thinking, actually, you can tell coming through in our youngest children that they haven't had the same exposure to speech and language that they would have had if they hadn't been born or going through their parent and toddler experiences during the time of COVID. So you see it there. And I think that's just going to take time to come through. But I do think we can't underestimate the enormity of it, because I think we need to consider what norms did it suggest to our young people that actually shouldn't be their norms. If we look at the issues of absenteeism that are around at the moment, and that's a national picture. And I think, you know, we're seeing that even coming through in some of the applicants from primary schools through to senior school. We're seeing much lower attendance levels than we're used to seeing. So I think in all sorts of different ways, as well as the ones that are well written about, we are going to see this come for a long time. And actually, sure, it's going to get better and better. And we're going to be better and better at solving it, I hope, and helping children and helping families. But I don't think it's going to go away in a hurry. I think closing schools is going to have a long-term effect for precisely the reason you suggested. That pause was quite remarkable, times two.
Yes, I suppose. And I don't know. I mean, talking to colleagues in the maintain sector, they say that year nine is where they're seeing a lot of problems. Of course, I suppose I'm talking to secondary school people, so maybe it's earlier as well. But certainly I'm finding that a little bit here. What do you think the sort of cohort that's been most affected, or do you see it across the board?
Yeah, do you know, I think I could probably draw you an argument for just about every year group having been affected, you know, and thinking that they had it the worst. The ones who didn't have a great experience at university, the ones who didn't get the great graduation experiences when they left the sixth form. But I also think that group you're talking about, you know, they didn't have all of those rite of passage moments that come with, you know, graduating from primary, going through being student leaders, you know, having all of that responsibility in year six. I think they're the ones who certainly then had the largest adjustment to come to senior school in such unusual circumstances. So I can see why that would be a particularly bulge issue, I think.
Shall we move on to sort of best practice and some ideas that you might share with what's happening at your school?
Sure. Well, I think, I mean, the mental health agenda, I think we're all working hard on, aren't we, across the piece? And so I think in common with many schools, some of what I say will be what's happening across the piece. But I think that we've certainly extended the mental health first aid training to a huge number of our staff, both teachers and support staff, really so that they can then, you know, spread the support available across the school, and that we're not just relying as heavily as we are on our medical team and our student support services function, our counselling service, all of those things that we know across the sector are being stretched to the limit. We've also got a safe space for those children to go. We've trained sixth formers how to be peer mentors, and they've also had first aid and mental health training at a lower level, but to make sure that they can be the first point of contact for young people. And then one of our most recent initiatives actually has been to develop the wellbeing program in sport, and to really focus on actually how can we make sure that mental and physical health are understood in the light of one another, and how that sort of that positive physical activity and routine can help you with your well-being. But we've had great speakers in from the sporting world, also people from, you know, wider world, you know, gambling awareness and other parts of well-being, but to come and talk to students, to just give them ideas, to share with them the sense of you're not on your own. If this is how you're thinking and feeling, you're not on your own, and there are things you can do to take control of a situation, which sometimes for our young people is often what they need, because they feel a little bit like they have no control.
Healthy body, healthy mind, back in fashion. There's nothing Absolutely. New under the sun, really, is there? Thomas Arnold would be right on there with that.
Just a quick message while you're here. My name's Simon, and I run the Bonjour Agency, the company behind the HMC podcast. Now, you might be listening to this episode thinking it could be good to have a podcast in your school for your own marketing. More and more parents are listening to podcasts than ever before. It's a great way to share the human side of your school so that people feel more connected to it. To find out more, just visit thebonjouragency.com and listen to some other examples from schools such as Downhouse, Whitgift, and Brentwood. But for now, let's get back into this episode.
to play devil's advocate for a minute on the mental health first aid, and I think a lot of schools are doing this, us too, so absolutely I'm with you on it. But I just wonder, is there a danger sometimes that by telling everyday teachers that they are responsible for this, it puts too much pressure on them, and also could create the danger that they're not moving pupils on to the professionals, the ones that really are at risk and need professional support?
Oh, I think that's a fair challenge, Tom, absolutely. One of the reasons that we've made our provision entirely voluntary, so we haven't forced it upon staff. We've said, for those of you who would like to do it, we will provide it. And then I think, to your point, just so that they then feel confident and comfortable in what they're doing, making it really clear where the red lines are and at what point must you then hand over this situation or recommend another course for this particular child. Because otherwise, you know, this is already a stressful and busy job teaching our children. And the demands that, you know, are placed on our schools and on the staff in our schools, both support and teaching, it's already huge. You know, we want to give the best to our families and our children. Our families expect it of us. Gosh, we don't want to pile on any more unless people are willing to do it. But we absolutely need to protect them when they do take more on. I think that's a really sound call for all of us, Tom.
Yes, I suppose it's the clues in first aid. It's mental health first aid. We're not asking for therapy, and it would be dangerous if teachers felt exactly. They could take that on. This used to be what visiting music teachers ended up doing when people hadn't done their practice. They would go into their music lessons and say, I'm feeling really rotten. Half an hour would go by and they never got caught out for not having done a jot of practice. But there we go. At least we professionalised it. I suppose another challenge really is this sort of snowflake generation question. When you said, of course, we've got a safe space, I'm thinking, yes, absolutely. But should that safe space be a mental one due to self-care, due to resilience built up by children, empowering them to help themselves rather than a sort of runaway to matron snug, if you like?
I think that's a great idea. I have to say, I couldn't agree more. I think one of the issues here, you know, isn't so much our young people and their resilience. I think it's actually supporting and helping parents, because I think the parents that I come across now, as opposed to those I met at the beginning of my career, you know, want to protect their children so much. And, you know, we're parents. It's a natural instinct. We understand it. But there comes a point when actually helping children to take responsibility, helping children to dig deep when they don't think they can anymore, helping them to build that resilience is so much better for them. And I wonder if a part of this issue isn't so much talking about, is it a snowflake generation or not, but actually is, can we better support parents to understand the importance of growing resilience in their children? I think for me, that would be the breakthrough. And at the moment, we have parents who are so desperate to protect their children. And I think especially after what they've all been through in the last few years, it's completely understandable, but I think actually they also need some help and support to try and get this balance right.
I mean, some would say that perhaps parents are even projecting their vulnerability on their children, and they're the ones that need the support and handholding more than ever before. But you'd not catch me saying that, Sue, because I love parents and their gorgeous fees. So no, but others might say that perhaps that's the problem, not me, no way, no how. How do you make plans in these uncertain times, Sue?
Golly, well, do you know, I mean, I think that, you know, development planning, I think, has always been a really exciting part of
really?
Being ahead. Yeah, I love thinking about the future. What do we want to do in 3 years' time? Where do we want to be in 5 years' time? I think that's really exciting. I also think it's a great way of bringing on members of our SLT to understand the strategic part of our roles and not just the let's make school function on a daily basis part of our roles. So for me, I love all of that. But I think that's just got a whole level more complicated now. And I think with the vagaries that we're facing and the different ways things could turn out, whether that be politically or any other way in the next few years, it's almost like we need to do the development planning, but we also now need to plan for different scenarios and to know which levers we'll pull depending on what the external push and pull factors are that we are facing. So I think that's been made altogether more challenging. But I do think that plan we have to, and understand the variety of options available to us we have to. And some schools will have more options than others. That's just a reality. But understanding that and and working with our teams, I think, is really important. I think making sure our governing bodies are fully up to speed with all of that too. And also, I would say making sure as best we can that we've briefed our staff. And it's that careful balance of you can't, you know, scare them, but you've got to make them understand the realities that we are facing as a sector and the journey that we're on as leaders and actually the options that we're looking at. And I think all of that is helpful, because when you then have to make those decisions, at least they understand the rationale. So for me, it's the bit that I've always loved, but it just got a whole lot more complicated.
Yeah, no, I see that. So that's wise advice, really. Not a lonely paperwork exercise for the chair and the head, but a collaborative stakeholder thing that's sort of live and has lots of and is adaptable and nimble.
Absolutely right. And actually, that can be really exciting, and it's a great way to develop staff.
But in the moments that you're not thrilled by development planning and enjoying yet another private school nativity with Cath Kidston towels on heads all over the shop, how do you look after your health and well-being?
Golly, I think, you know, most heads would probably say they're pretty bad at this, and I think we are, and we need to be much better role models, don't we? And I think that's slowly changing. I've got a deep faith, you know, and my faith is really important to me, and so that gives me a real sense of perspective. It reminds me that I'm absolutely not the be-all and end-all, even in my school, and it also reminds me to put things in perspective. So I think that's helpful. A long-suffering family, gosh, every head needs one of those, don't they? And dear knows what they'll say at the point of, you know, retirement. Actually, this is what it was really like living with you, Mum. But I do think that's also a really important element for health and well-being. And I love the theatre. When I'm in London, I love getting to the theatre. I love watching opera. If I can't get to London, I love watching it live from the Met or from Covent Garden at my local Everyman. I've just got into opera in the last few years, and I'm trying to learn a lot. So I think it's just doing the things that you love with the people you love, and pushing out time for that, because I would look back now on my career and think there've been too many times when I have compromised that and the people that matter most, because I have given everything in that moment to the school at a point when it's been all consuming. And I think that's kind of what heads are like, but I think we need to learn to look after ourselves and our families differently.
Yes, absolutely. I think we do need to look after ourselves and families and have a laugh as well.
You know,
a bit. I mean, it is very important, I think, for all the teams around us, but also for ourselves. And luckily, I find my own jokes so deeply brilliant.
It doesn't matter if nobody else laughs.
No, not at all. I find it brilliant. But we are going to encourage through this podcast series for people to share their sort of wit and wisdom, if you like, because I think it is good
That's
to be lighthearted
healthy.
From time yeah. to time.
I think they've got to look out for their swimwear. Can I mention swimwear, Tom?
Yes. Goodness, you'll get my heart a-fluttering, Sue.
So I think, you know, swimwear indeed, it's a top tip for heads out there, I think, wherever they are. My family have teased me for years mercilessly that I always think that there is a family connected to my school hiding behind every bush everywhere we go. And then sure enough, there I was on my beautifully relaxing Christmas holiday in the mid-Atlantic in a beautiful hotel, having a lovely FaceTime with my family who were in Australia and visiting the in-laws. And there we were, little nook in this beautiful hotel, middle of nowhere, my husband and I having our Christmas chat with our grandson, and who should walk by but this lady who then stops and reverses and turns to look at me and says, "It's Mrs. Woodruff from GSAL, isn't it?" And of course your heart sinks, because you're thinking, I really thought I was suitably hidden and I really thought this was my little private time. But yeah, 2 days later she found me again. She turned out to be one of my grandmas. She was with her husband, who's one of my grandpas. We had the most wonderful chat. She brought along her brother, who was also in the hotel, who's one of my old boys. So the only thing I would say is, given that I was on a lounger trying to cover every possible part of me with as many books as I could garner from the bag, just make sure your swimwear's up to scratch, because you never know when you're going to be spotted by somebody from your school.
Well, a top beach tip from a top head. Thank you very much, Sue. And thank you for being the guinea pig for this first episode. What do you hope will come out of this pilot podcast series?
Do you know, I would love it if people far more erudite and clever and witty than me would be able to chat with you every week and just be able to share some real knowledge-based, wisdom based on the real world, on our schools. We'll make each other smile. We'll give each other an idea or two that might then sink in and thought, oh, we'll try that when we're back at school. But above all, we'll build a real sense of community that even when we feel like we're quite alone in our own jobs and our own schools, actually we're not. We're part of an amazing HMC community. And I hope people will get that from it. And it would be wonderful if that were the case, Tom. I trust you completely.
Thank you so much, honoured chair. So now we get to the 2 minutes with a new member segment. Today we've got Helen Olds, the director of the schools at the British International School, Riyadh. Welcome, Helen. Can you give us 30 seconds on where you are from originally? And what's your subject and where you've worked before?
Thank you, Tom. Lovely to be here with you today. My name's Helen Olds and I am originally from Cornwall, a very proud Cornish girl, 25 miles from Land's End, but I managed to find my way out and have been working internationally for the last 20 years.
That's fantastic. So an area where pirates come from, rather like the Cinque-Port coasts of Kent and Sussex, where I am. If you weren't an educator or a pirate, what profession would you follow?
Well, I've thought long and hard about this one, and I would definitely be an astronaut because I think it plays into my love of travel, my sense of adventure, and my love of geography.
Oh, that's fantastic. Can you give us a little bit, Helen, for all the heads listening and others, how you switch off and what your passions are away from the classroom?
I have quite a few. I love lots of different things, but my major passion is scuba diving. I love being underwater because no one can email me, no one can phone me, no one can harass me, and there's a real sense of mindfulness, and I love it.
Oh, well, it is absolutely wonderful doing that. I've never had the gumption or perseverance to try. I'm just a snorkeler, but that does sound fantastic. What does stands your schools at the British International School of Riyadh out from the others? What's your elevator pitch?
We are a wonderful community school. We have 7 campuses, but none of those campuses are too big because we want to keep that family friendly feel about it. And Saudi Arabia is an incredibly exciting place to be at the moment. The pace of change here is incredible, and it's a really exciting time to be part of that and to be growing and developing as a school within their Vision 2030 and really putting British education on the map.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. And are you new to the HMC or have you been in the HMC before?
Yeah, I'm a very new member to HMC. In fact, at the conference, I think I was your newest member and it was wonderful. I had such a great welcome from everybody. Got a chance to chat to Sue as well and felt really part of the family. So thank you to everyone who made me feel so welcome.
Well, Helen, you are part of the family. Welcome again to the HMC. It's wonderful having you on board and thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for listening. Please do get in touch by emailing pod@hmc.org.uk with any topics or comments, and particularly, as we said, any humorous notes we can share, including, if you're so minded, your suggestions for the name of this podcast. That's pod@hmc.org.uk. So thank you very much, Helen, and for our main guest, Sue. I've been your host, Tom Lawson. Sayonara for now.